Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As summer rolls around, the birds fly back north, the cold retreats. But it's never far from mine for my guest today, Alaska biologist Bill Strever. He's fascinated by the cold, worried about it too, as climate change and global warming heat up. His new book is all about the world of cold. Polar bears, ice caps, deep freezes, absolute zero. This hour On Point, we're tackling the cold, real cold, and talking about what it means for life on Earth. You can join the conversation. What's your exposure to cold? Do you love it, hate it? With a climate that's changing, warming, would you be glad to see cold go or not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Anchorage, Alaska, is Bill Strever. He's a biologist, chair of the Science Technical Advisory Panel for the North Slope Science Initiative. His new book out this week is Cold: Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. Bill Strever, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you start right out with a wonderful little bit from Mark Twain from his Following the Equator, 1897, and he writes, "The captain had been telling how, in one of his Arctic voyages, it was so cold that the mate's shadow froze fast to the deck and had to be ripped loose. He only got two-thirds of it back. Are you bringing us cold, tall tales, Bill?"
Well, you have to have fun with your subject, I think, and, you know, I didn't want to start off on too serious a note.
Good to start with Twain, then. You're an Alaskan. I guess that means, by definition, you kind of like or appreciate the cold.
Absolutely. Love the cold.
What is it that people don't understand about cold? We've all been in winter. We've all been chilly. What are you trying to tell us about cold that we don't already know?
Well, I think I'm trying to tell you, celebrate cold. So many people seem to avoid cold, turn the thermostat up, put on a sweater. And yet there's so many great things about cold that we just sort of ignore or don't appreciate. It's an underappreciated feeling.
You come right out saying, let's remember what cold is. It's just an absence of heat. Take away the heat and you're cold. I guess that's obvious, but people don't often think about what cold is.
Well, that's right. And I guess there's a lot of different ways to think about cold. You can think of it as the absence of heat or slowing down of molecular motion. But then you can also think of it as all kinds of different feelings, shivering and numbness and ranging on downward to very, very bad things, I suppose. You can also think of it as a comfort if you're on the, say, the east coast of the U.S. today. I'm sure it's quite warm over there.
It could be warmer. We were sort of hoping it'd be blazing hot and you'd be an ice cube for us, you know, a little refreshing, cool, but it could be warmer, though around the country we've got some high temperatures today. You start right off, Bill, taking a kind of the sort of very coldest kind of plunge yourself. You're up on the north coast of Alaska, not far from Prudhoe Bay, just a couple of days after the ice has broken up and gone out there. Oddly enough, this is something I've done years ago as well, but you're braver at it than me. You plunge in to 35-degree water or so with the big ice still bobbing around and challenge yourself to stay there for nearly 5 minutes. What was that like, Bill?
Well, it's an experience. I think everyone should try it. And plunging in, I think, is the right way to do it. I do this probably more often than other people. And I know lots of folks go up to Prudhoe Bay and up to Barrow and take the polar bear plunge. And usually it's a quick dip, and then they run out. And I guess what I wanted to do was to somewhat to test myself, but also just to get the experience in case I ever do fall off of a boat or something like that. And the first thing that happens, of course, when you hit cold water, you get this really strong gasp reflex. So your brain is telling your body, breathe, breathe, breathe. And the bad thing that can happen if you're underwater and you give in to that gasp reflex, you'll get a lung full of water. And, of course, that's the end of you. And that's why you hear all these stories of people not lasting more than a minute in cold water. It's because they drown from that gasp reflex.
Now, years
so once you get past the gasp reflex, that's a couple of minutes, and that's gone, and then you can last quite a long time in cold water.
Years ago, I used to work on the North Slope back in the big oil days up there, and worked for a kind of a famous guy, Jim Taylor, who was an oil guy, and he had a tradition that if he was there when the ice went out, and we were, it went booming out like thunder in the night, the next morning he would go out, walk, up to his chest and smoke a cigar standing there. Now, he smoked pretty fast. I tried it. I was out before I even knew that I had retreated. I'm very impressed that you stayed a full 5 minutes. What happens to a human body standing in, you know, all but freezing water as those minutes tick by, Bill?
Yeah, well, the first thing that happens, the gasp reflex we talked about, then that kind of disappears, and you're starting to feel normal, although admittedly the intense cold is a little bit painful. I think most people would describe
it as say.
Painful or stinging.
Mm-hmm.
Your skin feels like it's tightening up. Pretty quickly, your blood is running away from your extremities. Your veins are constricting in your extremities, in your fingers, in your toes, and the warm blood is concentrating in the middle of your body. Within 3 or 4 minutes, your mind is starting to slow down. It's still got a long way to go before you're really in trouble, but you can definitely feel yourself going through a process.
You remind us, you've got so many great anecdotes in here, but as you were there, you remind us of this terrible story but from 1940 off the coast of Norway when a German troop carrier went down, dumped its load of German troops, 79 of them, into that 35-degree water. And the difference between those who survived and those who did not, can you tell us that story?
Well, yeah, to the extent I can remember it. It's, you've covered most of it, but the people that were wise enough to keep their clothes on, so sure it was harder to swim with your clothes on, but it kept them somewhat warmer. Everyone got up onto a rescue boat, but the ones who had their clothes on survived. The ones that did not have their clothes on went into what's sometimes called afterdrop, so their core temperature, even though they're out of the water now and they're in a warm place, their core temperature continued to drop, and then they dropped and they died one by one.
But kind of peacefully, they got in their beds and just drifted off to sleep. You didn't. So your 5 minutes didn't take you to that point, or you were warmed up quickly enough afterward? Why?
Oh, well, nowhere near that point. 5 minutes isn't long enough to drop you into severe hypothermia. There's a lot of myths out there about cold water, and one of them is this myth that you'll succumb in just a few minutes. And really what happens, the gasp reflex hits, and if you get past that and you don't drown, you can last quite a long time, and it depends if you're moving or not moving and what sort of clothes you have on, but you might last an hour. And then the next thing that starts to happen is that your muscles start to cramp, so if you're not wearing some kind of flotation device, you'll drown at that point. And that's why you'll often hear people say, well, if you fall through the ice and you can't get back up, before you lose consciousness, you want to freeze your arms to the ice so that you don't drown, with the hope that someone comes along and drags you out.
Wow.
Because you still can be warmed back up and quite likely survive. So you really have quite a long time if you're well-dressed and you keep your head together. Of course, a survival suit is really the way to go around cold water, but if you don't have one and you're in the water, it's not all hope is not lost for quite a while.
You've got great stories that you're spinning as you stand there in the Arctic, 35-degree waters, and one of them right off the Bering Sea, and the Dutch navigator it's named after, Vitus Bering, I guess, and the story of his pretty bad Christmas season in 1741. Tell us that.
Yeah, well, Bering was an amazing guy. He was Dutch, as I think you just mentioned, working for the Russians, sailing in the northern waters, trying to see what was out there. And even just to launch his vessels, he had to go through a tremendous journey across frontier Russia to get to the coast. Built his ships, launched his ships, and went out to sea. Eventually winds up more or less shipwrecked. His men are on the island, and bear in mind, these crews were not the not the well-disciplined military crews that one might expect in a world-class Navy today. This was sort of a ragtag group, and not necessarily all following the leader at this point. Lots of scurvy, beginning of hunger setting in, at least the beginning of hunger, and people lying on the beach sick with scurvy and other diseases and dying from exposure as Bering laid there. And at least according to some accounts, Arctic foxes were nipping at his men and feeding on the bodies of the dead and dying as Bering himself laid and died.
The screams and moans of his dying men and the Bering Sea, ultimately named for him, separating Russia and Alaska there. I mean, you've got lots of stories here that hardly make cold seem endearing. Exposure was part of what was killing them right there, and yet you keep coming back to it. You know, big fan of cold.
Well, you know, yeah, that's part of the celebration. There is a certain risk there, I suppose, when it's very cold and you're hanging out over the edge, and that's part of what makes it interesting and enjoyable, but only part of it.
And you go right on down through the stories. We'll hear more of them. Right down to absolute zero. What's absolute zero again, Bill?
Well, absolute zero is the coldest possible temperature. So cold does have an absolute, as the name would imply, and that's when molecular motion stops. So in normal day-to-day life, we're quite warm. But at something like, from memory, minus 459 degrees Fahrenheit, I think, or 0 degrees Kelvin, molecular motion just stops dead in its tracks, and it's very hard to imagine what that would be like because you're into the realm of quantum physics. So the universe sort of changes a little bit, let's say, and it's sometimes called the death of matter.
Does it exist anywhere, absolute zero, or it's just a concept?
In a way, it's a concept. It's sort of like the speed of light. It's an unreachable goal. But in 1995, a couple of scientists, Wyman and Cornell, I think were their names, here in the States, they came within about a billionth of a degree of absolute zero, and I believe that people have come even closer since then.
Watch out where the Huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow. Watch out where the Huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the cold, a little Antarctic wind blowing behind us from March of the Penguins in 2005. We're looking at the low end of the thermometer, what it means and what it's meant to life on Earth, cold. Bill Strever is with us, a biologist from Alaska. He's out with a new book, Cold Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. Bill, here's a little sound I think you collected yourself near Barrow, Alaska, way up there in the cold north, of the bearded seal, the spiraling whistle of the bearded seal. Let's listen. Holy smokes, that is fantastic. Where did you record that, Bill? What's going on?
Well, yeah, that was recorded by a colleague, and that's a very common sound up in the northern waters around the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea. Just an incredible animal, the bearded seal. It's sort of a large seal for the Arctic. The natives hunt the Eskimo natives hunt that seal and make skin boats from it. But that sound is just, to my ear, it's one of the most amazing natural sounds in the world. And at certain times of year, in certain areas under the sea ice, you can hear these just a cacophony of these seals talking to each other. Apparently, who knows what they're saying, but talking to each other with these spiraling whistles.
That's just unbelievable. It's so amazing. I have to play it again. It sounds like modern music. This is the spiraling whistle of the bearded seal near Barrow, Alaska. Wow. And it's colder. What is the bearded seal's relationship to cold, Bill?
Well, to me, the relationship with the bearded seal is partly its adaptations to living in very, very cold water, but also its adaptations to living under the sea ice. So, like all marine mammals, it's an air breather, but yet it lives under sea ice that, to most people, is continuous. So you look out at the sea ice and you think, holy cow, how could any air-breathing animal live under this stuff? And yet they do. Bearded seals and ring seals, especially ring seals, are very good at finding small openings in the sea ice and even maintaining those openings with their claws. So all winter long they live under the sea ice. They might have a cave that they'll crawl out inside of in the sea ice, but they won't be on the surface of the ice at all in the wintertime.
Let's get a little more of beasts who love the cold. Here's the call of the beluga whale just off Cook Island near Anchorage. That honk off Cook Inlet, the creature there. You pay a lot of attention to humans and creatures here. Give us some more stories of, squirrels whose blood freezes, frogs who turn into frog sickles, what caterpillars who actually are totally frozen and come back to life, Bill.
That's right, Tom. You're stealing all my best stories.
Let's hear them.
Yeah, you can work your way up from the animals like insects, and some insects do freeze solid in the winter. The woolly bear caterpillar of the far north is a good example. And it's a caterpillar. It eventually turns into a moth, but that takes 6 or 7 years, so it'll stay a caterpillar most of its life, and then for a very short time fly around as a moth and lay eggs and reproduce. So those guys freeze solid. Other insects do what's called supercooling, so they'll stay very, very still, and they're their body temperature will drop just below freezing, but their blood won't actually freeze. And you can do the same thing with water. You can cool water below 32 degrees Fahrenheit or below zero Celsius and not freeze the water so that it's super cooled. But then if you just tap the side of the bottle or shake the bottle, it will suddenly freeze. It'll flash freeze. And a lot of people don't know that, but you can see it on YouTube, for example. If you Google, I think, super cooling, you can find all kinds of video clips where people are flash freezing bottles of water. And there's insects that get through the winter by staying super cooled. You move into frogs, and there is, I think, now four species of frog that are known to actually freeze solid in the winter. The wood frog is the one we have up here in Alaska, and it sort of crawls under some leaves or under some debris, and its body freezes. If you found one in the winter, it would appear to be dead and frozen solid and hard, and yet in the spring it would thaw out and crawl away. A nice trick, right?
Yes. What does that say about chirogenics, Bill, and the humans who have frozen themselves and hoping to come back? Are we so different from the frog that it's out of the question or not?
Well, I guess the folks that run cryogenics institutes might have an opinion about that. My own opinion is that right now, certainly, we don't know how to thaw out frozen humans. There's some physiological processes that happen in frogs and in insects and in plants, for that matter, before they freeze to protect the cells. So really what's going on is that the animal is evacuating as much of the fluid out of the inside of its cells as it possibly can, flushing that fluid out into the area between the cells. So really what's freezing is the liquid between the cells and not the liquid that's inside the cells themselves. And that's really, I think, how the frog survives and how these various insects survive and how plants survive. Because if you have those ice crystals forming inside your cell and poking around in all those delicate organelles that are inside of the cell and poking from the inside of the cell membrane, that causes all kinds of damage, and it's very unlikely that you would come out of that. But there are, as you pointed out, people that believe in cryonics. The idea is that you die, and I think you have to be officially dead first. Nobody can volunteer to have this done to them while they're still alive, so you're officially dead from something. And I think the first person who was cryogenically preserved was a man named James Bedford back in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
He died from a form of cancer, was immediately processed for cryonics and frozen in liquid nitrogen. I believe he's still frozen in liquid nitrogen somewhere down in the southwestern U.S. And the idea is that at some point there will be a cure for the particular cancer that killed him, and there will also be a way to thaw him out and wake him up, and he'll then continue on with life. So it's, I suppose, a ticket to a very low-temperature immortality.
You do have the story of a mammal whose blood actually essentially turns to ice, the ground squirrel, and comes back from that. How's that work?
Well, it drops below freezing. It doesn't quite turn to ice, but it does drop below freezing. And the ground squirrel is an amazing animal. It's an animal of the Arctic or of high mountains, and it looks a little bit more like a prairie dog than like a squirrel. And it stands up on its hind legs and looks around. It's a very endearing, chubby little thing that entertains us all summer long. And then in the fall, it crawls into a hole in the rock somewhere and lays down and goes into a deep hibernation. And through the winter, its temperature drops and drops and drops and drops. It would, to all appearances, would not have no heartbeat and not be breathing. And its blood temperature would drop down to 32 Fahrenheit, down to 31, down to 30. And then it would spontaneously start to shiver. So it's a bit mysterious why it would trigger the shivering when it's that cold, what metabolic processes are going on to kind of hit the switch to start shivering. But that's exactly what it does. It starts to shiver. Starts to warm back up, and then over a day or so, its body temperature comes back up to something approximating normal for that squirrel, and its brain waves go into a dream pattern. So it goes from this state of deep hibernation into what seems to be normal sleep for about a day, dreaming whatever squirrels dream about.
Nuts.
And then it starts to cool off again, and it goes cycles back and forth like this all winter. And of course, every time it shivers, every time it starts to warm up, it's burning calories. And if it does that too many times, it'll starve to death before spring. So if it has to be careful which rocks it crawls into and hope for at least a reasonable mild winter or face starvation before spring rolls around.
Shivering just above ice in the veins. A lot of animals that are amazingly get along with the cold. Here's the bowhead whale. This is recorded by Bill off of Barrow in the Beaufort Sea. Sounds cold to me. Let's go to our listeners. Charleston, South Carolina. Nice and toasty. Gilbert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A story I have, you were asking for stories. In 1982, I was in the Army in Hohenfels, Germany, and we were doing a simulated night assault. And we were told not to bring anything with us because we'd be back by midnight. And we did our night assault, and it was midnight, and we weren't going back, and the temperature dropped tremendously. It's snowing, and, of course, a lot of us got really cold, and I thought I was going to die, freeze to death that night.
From the pain, from the cane, from the pain, Gilbert, or did you literally think, good Lord, I'm dying?
Well, it was so cold, I didn't know what was going to happen. And we certainly weren't. People were getting medevaced out for frostbite. And I started shivering, and I could not make myself stop shivering. And it was I never had an experience like that of being out in a cold and not being able to warm up. And what I eventually did was a couple other soldiers and I got together underneath some pine trees and started snapping pine branches off to make a bed and cover, and that's what we did until morning.
Huddled there and surviving, but wondering if you would. It's a great cold story. I appreciate it, Gilbert. Let's get another from Boxborough, Massachusetts. And Ann, hi, Ann, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, my story is I grew up in Minnesota, and in the 70s, in 1975, we set a record where we went 67 days without ever getting above zero. And
wow.
So, yeah, it was, you know, everyone in that area definitely knew the dangers of cold and how to survive them. And one day I was trying to get to school and had plugged in the battery in our Volvo because that's the only way to get it started in
right.
the middle of winter.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, the engine was too cold to crank. I don't remember the temperature that day, but my sister and I both had tests, so we had to start walking. We didn't even get a block, and, you know, this was in the days of maxi coats and everything else, so we were definitely layered, but I said, we got to turn around. I can't feel the skin on my legs. So I, you know, also wanted to comment that during that time in science class in the 1970s, we were being taught that we were headed for the next ice age.
Right.
I definitely have an appreciation for cold. I moved to Massachusetts out of a southern clime because I love the four seasons, and I'm sad to see it going away.
Ann, that's a great story, and thanks for it. Bill, I mean, winter cold, Ann's describing Minnesota here. You've got Alaska winters. Winter cold really does mean different things in different parts of the country. It's just a different quality of cold.
Oh, absolutely. Even here in Alaska, it's a very different quality of cold as you move up from the south central coast around Anchorage and move into the interior where it's much, much colder but very still, not much wind. Temperatures down into minus 40, minus 50, and then up into the North Slope where it's still minus 40, maybe minus 50 or even colder, but also windy. So lots of changes as you move up the coast, and the humidity drops, too, and that makes a big difference.
You've got the story, this is from a ways back, a century back in Montana, of the so-called school children's blizzard. Tell us about that, Bill.
Excuse me. The school children's blizzard of 1888. Excuse me. People woke up. It was a very nice day, and they sent their kids off to school, much like we just heard from Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And the blizzard came in very suddenly, unpredicted. There was the beginnings of a weather service at that time. And the weather service missed the prediction. A blizzard came in, and kids started making their way home and grew lost in the snow, blowing snow. And dozens of kids froze to death. There's lots of stories that stand out, three brothers frozen together, huddled. Their father found their bodies and had to carry them back to his sod farm and thaw them out in front of a wood stove. A young woman named Etta Shattuck, I believe was her name, dove into a haystack. That's kind of like Gilbert's story about building a bed of pine branches. She dove into a haystack and survived the storm, but later died from terrible complications from frostbite. So it's a great story, and David Laskin tells that story in his book, The Children's Blizzard.
You had cattle found frozen in place as if they were grazing with their breath formed into balls of ice around their heads. It almost sounds like a Mark Twain story there. The temperature going from 40 to 9 degrees and minus 40 wind chill in just 5 hours or so in Helena, Montana.
Well, that's right, and that's definitely not a Mark Twain exaggeration. I think a lot of people who live in cattle country where it's very cold could tell you similar stories. I've actually seen that with a frozen muskox.
Amazing. Let's get a cold story from sunny Los Angeles, California. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I love your show. You've always got such interesting topics.
Great. What do you know?
Well, it's funny. You're asking for stories about the cold, and I actually have two. When I was a kid, I went skiing. I dropped a $20 bill off the ski lift. I was with my friend, and we bet one another to see who could get there first.
Okay.
I ended up skiing off of a cliff accidentally because I was in such a rush to get down there. And landed on some logs, had to climb back up about a 15-foot snowdrift to get back on the trail. And by the time I did, I was into hypothermia. Somebody found me because there were not very many people skiing that day. Somebody finally found me, and they brought the ski patrol. And by the time they got me down to the lodge, my core temperature was down around, I think, 93, 94.
Oh, yeah.
The second story is I was up in Alaska, and for a vacation with my girlfriend, we decided to go to Dawson City in the Yukon.
Mm-hmm.
On the way back, a blizzard came in, dumped a bunch of snow, but I was in a hurry to get back to Fairbanks, where I was. So we took our four-wheel drive, and we ended up driving. We hit a snowdrift in the road and ended up driving over a mountainside to get around the snowdrift, and then found ourselves between two giant snowdrifts blocking the road late in the day with the temperature dropping. Fortunately, we had a shovel that I bought off of some miners that we ran into earlier that day, a couple of gold miners, and we ended up digging our way out of the snowdrift. It took us about 6 hours.
Did you think you were going to die, Phil? Die from cold? Did it seem like a possibility?
Absolutely. I thought that was probably it, that, I'd done my last big adventure, and that was it, and they were going to find us in the spring when we finally thawed out.
Phil, thanks for your call from Los Angeles. We've got to take a short break right here. We're talking about cold and cold stories from all over with Bill Strever. He joins us from Anchorage, a biologist there, author of the new book, Cold Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There's the sound of ice floes colliding, if you can't recognize it. I'm not sure at all that I would. We're talking today about the cold, the low end of the thermometer, what it means and what it's meant to life on Earth with Bill Strever, biologist based in Alaska and author of the new book, Cold Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. And he's got great cold stories and cold science here. Bill, you've got a lot of great stories about explorers who deliberately sought out the coldest places on this planet. We should share a few more of those with us. Maybe Robert Falcon Scott and the penguin egg story of 1911. That was some cold work.
Well, that was definitely some cold work. And maybe we can back up a little, though, before we talk about Scott and the story of the penguin eggs and just go back to two of our callers, Gilbert and I think Phil both mm-hmm. talked about some cold experiences, and Gilbert talked about shivering through the night, and he could seem to feel like he couldn't imagine being any colder than that. And yet he did say that he was still shivering. Phil, on the other hand, talked about being rescued from a skiing event, what's mm-hmm. called an event, mm-hmm. where he got off the trail and got much colder than he expected to and had a core temperature down around 93 or 94. We didn't have a chance to ask Phil, but I suspect he was pretty close to being at a temperature where he would have stopped shivering. You're really in trouble if you're out in the cold and you're shivering and then you suddenly find yourself no longer shivering. You know you've got problems going on, so that's a warning sign to watch out.
Is there a specific body temperature that means death?
I think it varies for different people. And people have been revived from very, very cold temperatures, especially, you know, the very common stories about kids who fall through the ice and they're revived sometimes with brain damage, sometimes mm-hmm. without brain damage after being underwater for quite a long time in cold temperatures. But the other thing we heard from Phil, both of his stories, one was about chasing after a $20 bill and being in a hurry to find it
yeah.
on skis, and
mm-hmm.
the other one was being in a hurry to drive from Dawson City back to Fairbanks, I think he said. Both times he got himself in trouble, and both times he was in a hurry. And I think seasoned travelers in the Arctic, they learn pretty quickly that it's no place to be in a hurry when the temperatures are down below, 20 below and 30 below, 40 below. That's a time when you really need to be taking your time and thinking about your options and your back door. How are you going to get out of this if things go wrong?
The molecules slow down, and you should, too. Slow down and be deliberate. Be careful.
Well, that's right. That's right. And one of the things that happens as you become colder and colder is that your brain starts to slow down. And you really don't have to be that cold to start feeling that. For me, it feels like almost like I start to have tunnel vision and start to become overly focused on a particular objective rather than watching what's going on all around me. And when I notice myself doing that, I always say to myself, okay, it's time to stop here, really assess the situation, try to warm up, maybe move around a little bit or something. If I'm on a snow machine, for example, get up and do some jumping jacks or something like that to get the blood flowing.
We heard some Antarctic wind earlier, and you've got the story of the guys sent after emperor penguin eggs. 1911, tough job.
Tough job and tough guys. Those were some amazing guys. You know, I live here in Alaska, and I know a lot of people that are considered pretty tough when it comes to cold temperatures and survival in the wilderness, but these guys that were with Scott were absolutely amazing, traveling at really, really brutal temperatures back before modern fabrics and modern rescue techniques, chasing after, in the Antarctic winter, chasing after emperor penguin eggs, with temperatures, if I remember right, down as low as 70 below, and when it rose up to 50 below, talking about how warm it was and how much more pleasant it was at 50 below than at 70 below. And before their trip was over, before they retrieved these eggs, wishing for death, even though they continued to push on, and you can imagine what this would have been like. You just never would have been warm. Even when they were stopping to sleep, they weren't warm, and their sleeping bags were filling with moisture from the steam coming off their bodies was filling their sleeping bags, and that would freeze at night, and before the end of the trip, they'd have several pounds of frozen water in the bottom of their sleeping bags that would have to be warmed up by their bodies
wow.
as they crawled into those bags at night. And
hauling a sled 60 miles in the dark at 70 degrees below zero, you know, not so far from Antarctica. You've got this great report from Charles Darwin, of all people, way back in 1832, about the physical adaptation of humans living on the Tierra del Fuego to the cold.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good story. And that's you know, Darwin, I love Darwin. He's just a fantastic guy. And I think people have a vision of Darwin in their minds. It's always Darwin as an older man when he's writing back in England, and he's sort of living the gentleman's life and writing books about evolution or about natural selection. But when he was a younger man, he was probably not all that worldly when he got onto the Beagle and started sailing around the world collecting data. And he spent a lot of his time seasick. And he sails into South America, into Tierra del Fuego, and he sees these Alakaluf natives, and they're naked, and it's cold out, and in one case it was sleeting. And he's looking at this woman who's virtually naked, and she's holding a naked baby against her breast, and there's sleet running down her back, and he looks at her and says or writes something to the effect of her being the most miserable person that he's ever seen, that he just couldn't imagine living that way. But in fact, these natives and several other groups in that part of the world had evolved a metabolism that allowed them to stay quite comfortable at temperatures that left Darwin feeling very cold. So this woman probably wasn't miserable at all. She was probably looking at this seasick, pale Englishman wondering what he was doing out there.
A metabolism, you report, Bill, a metabolism as much as 40% higher than ordinary humans.
Well, that's right. I mean, and they, of course, they are ordinary humans. They're just a different genetic strain and had different selective forces on their genetic heritage. So they had evolved this metabolism that was much higher than that of, say, Darwin or of you or of me.
Yeah.
In other parts of the world, there were other adaptations. The certain aboriginals in southern Australia, where it also gets quite cold, not nearly as cold as in Tierra del Fuego, but it does get quite cold in southern Australia. And some of the local people there had adapted a tolerance for hypothermia. So each night, as they would sleep, their body temperatures would drop. But rather than starting to shiver and being woken up by the cold like you or I would do, they would not shiver. Their body temperature would just drop, and then in the morning they would wake up and they would warm back up, and that didn't bother them at all.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. Let's get a call from Burlington, Vermont, and Peggy. Hi, Peggy. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say that a lot of people have to work in these really frigid temperatures. I was a veterinarian in North Dakota, where the temperatures are not unlike the Arctic. It's not unusual there to be 40 degrees below zero.
Mm-hmm.
And time after time in the spring, the temperatures would be 20, 15 below. I was stripped to my shirt sleeves doing a C-section on a cow in a corral. Some of the ranch practice out there, you have to be pretty
rugged
to deal with it.
Yep.
But I think the coldest temperature I ever worked in, this farmer had an outbreak of blackleg in his cattle. It was in December, and he had lost three. We got the lab results back. I had to vaccinate him. And on the day that I had to vaccinate 80 head of cattle, the chill factor was minus 70 degrees.
Wow.
Well, the problem was keeping the vaccine from freezing. So we warmed it. It was a killed vaccine, so I warmed it on the stove and then stuck it in my snowmobile suit and then just climbed up on the corral and shot the cattle. Boom, 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 boom. You know, it didn't take 15 minutes to vaccinate them. But that was really, really cold. And then one day I was called out to the farmer found his cow down in the pasture. It was about 20 degrees above zero, but the wind was blowing. So the chill factor was down around zero. She had a dead calf in her. We couldn't move her, so we had the pickup lights shining on this cow, and because the calf was dead and so beginning to rot, all swollen and so forth, the incision line was quite a bit bigger than usual. So it took me about an hour to save this cow. It took me about 2 days to warm up again, but all veterinarians experience this that work in North Dakota, Montana. We're forced to work in the cold because we have emergencies.
With large animals, they're going to be spread all over the terrain. Those are great cold stories, working in the cold. No strangers, Alaskans, Bill, to working in cold. I mean, Peggy's got great North Dakota stories there. You live among people who spend a lot of the year working in the cold.
Well, sure, yeah. It's a very common experience, and I liked what Peggy said about it took her, I think she said, 2 days to feel warm again.
Yeah.
And some of that, of course, is psychological, but some of it's real. Your core temperature drops, and it takes you a long time to warm up.
You've got this amazing story of a missionary up in northern Canada who chose to live in the coldest quarters I've ever quite imagined. Tell us the story of Father, what is it, Henry?
Father Henry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Father Henry moved up to one of the villages in northern Canada, and as a spiritual act, he decided to keep himself focused by living in what most people would consider to be a very uncomfortable setting. So he lived in an ice cellar, and even the native people that he lived amongst, I'm certain they thought he was totally crazy. But he lived in an ice cellar, and he ate frozen fish, and of course that's not that uncommon, or was not at that time that uncommon in that part of the world to eat frozen fish. Freezing is a way of cooking things, it's sometimes said. So he would get up in the morning and gnaw on some frozen fish, and digesting those frozen fish would keep him warm, and he went about his life.
As a kind of spiritual exercise, but I think I read somewhere in this wonderful collection, and it goes from the scientific to the poetic, but that Dante's lowest circle of hell was not fire, but ice.
Well, that's right. Yeah, and a lot of people, you know, we all know Dante, right? And we all know the circles of hell from Dante and all these kinds of things, but most of us don't really remember the details of the literature that we have floating around in our minds. And yeah, the lowest circle of hell was ice, and Satan himself was emerging from the ice, I think, with his chest up above the ice and his head and arms up above the ice, and as Dante told the story. Another story that people don't really associate with cold because they've forgotten the original is Shelley's Frankenstein.
Remind us of the cold connection. It's the second time Frankenstein's come up with us this week. What's the cold connection?
Well, the cold connection is that, there's a couple of cold connections. The connection in the story itself, in the novel, is that it's told by via letters that are being sent back from the Arctic, and the Frankenstein monster is pursuing Dr. Frankenstein across the sea ice. Wow. And eventually the monster itself disappears into the Arctic sea ice.
It all depends where you're coming from. You open the book with reminding us of Frederick Tudor out of Boston. In 1833, shipping ice from Walden Pond, the famed Walden Pond, to India under sail. Clearly, Indians were going to be very happy to see that show up from Walden Pond, but that's a long trip by sail. Let's go to Ludlow, Vermont, and Phil. Phil, you're on the air.
Yes, I've got a funny story from going to school at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which I'm sure Bill knows about.
Mm-hmm.
One time, me and a college friend of mine were up there during Thanksgiving break, and this was our first semester up in Fairbanks. And I had this old Land Rover. Matter of fact, it's the same vehicle I still drive now. And English Land Rovers aren't really set up for cold all that much, being more for use in like Africa and what have you. So we decided, okay, we've got this two day or 3 day break. We're going to head out of Fairbanks and head down to Seward, Alaska. And it was like cold that weekend. It was like maybe 48 below zero, somewhere around there, and which is not unheard of for November in Alaska. And so we're driving along, and almost no heat in the Land Rover. So me and my friend Ed are dressed in all the down we could, possibly get a hold of, down jacket, down pants, down everything. Even we had blankets with us too. And so we're driving along, and it's like 48 to 50 below zero. It gets a little bit colder outside of Fairbanks, and somewhere around Healy, which is an area I'm sure Bill is familiar with, on the Parks Highway, we came across almost like a vapor barrier, and it went instantly from 48 to 50 below zero to, I'd estimate, 20 above. And because of that, the physics involved, the whole inside of the Land Rover just turned to instant fog. I mean, just instantly, and couldn't see a thing. So there was a gas station, luckily that was right up ahead of us that we could just barely see, and it was an Igloo gas station, which is a fairly famous one up there.
And off you went to an Igloo gas station. Our time is short. We've got the 50 below and vapors in the Land Rover and cold stories just with no end. But you warn us, Bill, that there could be an end. Are you really worried about the loss of cold? Does global warming really make cold an endangered quality?
Oh, I don't think cold is endangered. There will be plenty of opportunity to shiver our way through a night for some time to come. But we are seeing some big changes, and one of those big changes, one of the most obvious ones, is the remarkable decrease in sea ice in the summertime. So anybody that wants to can get online and Google sea ice, and they can see satellite images of sea ice from last September, sort of the end of the warm season up north. Look at the sea ice extent from last September and from the September in 2007, and compare that to sea ice trends for the 20 previous years, and it's really quite shocking the amount of sea ice that has disappeared. And with that, we're seeing all kinds of other things. We're starting to see warmer temperatures in the ground ice, so lots of the ground in Alaska below the first 10 or so inches has been permanently frozen, but the area that thaws out every year is deepening, and as that happens, the ground surface is changing as well. So So lots of things going on with the loss of cold.
And as a biologist, we've just got half a minute, but the consequence of that, catastrophic, survivable, how do you look at it?
Hard to say. You know, life always surprises us. I'd like to be optimistic and say survivable and things are going to be fine, but I think it's going to be a rocky road, especially for some of the very special animals of the north. The polar bear is the first one that jumps out, but the ring seal is probably not going to do so well with limited sea ice either.
Well, it's been a wonderful hour of cold stories, and it focuses us on the qualities of cold that we don't want to lose. Bill Strieber's new book is Cold Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. Bill, stay cold when you want to be and warm when you need to be, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It was great talking to you and great talking to your callers.
Great having you. Bill Strieber with us there from Anchorage, Alaska. Listeners, hope you're just the right temperature today, whatever that may be for you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
I'll just remember the wind and the snow.